Good morning. I'm Chris, for those of you who don't know me. I am a proud intern of Evanston Vineyard. I'm a student at Trinity Divinity School in Deerfield. And we're preaching through James still. So this James 5, 1 through 12 are our verses today. Next week's our last sermon on James, and you won't want to miss it. Ted is closing the book for us. And then we're going to do other stuff. I'm a little bit excited personally to move on from James. But I think God still has stuff for us in James. So James 5, 1 through 12 is the passage for today. Just by way of more introduction, I'm from Houston originally. So I grew up in the South, which means that I didn't know that pothole season was a thing. And it deeply unsettles me that once a year our streets just crumble. Like the concrete, the asphalt under our cars just goes away. You'd think concrete, asphalt, those are things that are supposed to last forever, right? Not in Chicago. And I'm sure you've been watching, on a less lighthearted note, you've been looking at the footage coming from Ukraine. And to me, one of the things, obviously, the violence and unjust suffering that's happening there is devastating to look at. But there's more than that. I think there's something deeply unsettling about watching a city fall apart. Watching things like a movie theater that used to be there just turn into ash or rubble. Watching the things that we think of as permanent disappear. Roads and shops and apartment complexes that housed lives just turned into rebar and sheetrock. Images like that, events like this, they cause us to see the fragility of the worlds that we create with a stark realism. So you can't ignore the fragility of life and of the world that we assume to be permanent. But most of the time in our everyday life, we kind of pretend like we're immortal, right? We take the persistence of the ordinary for granted. We just kind of assume that things will stay as they are. And this is causing us to look full in the face the reality that this world is passing away. We heard last week Renee preach about James 4. James's encouragement was that we should not take the future for granted. James says, your life is a mist. So don't expect to be able to make your plans come to pass by your own strength. You can't even predict what tomorrow holds. That's what James says in James 4. And the question for us this morning that I think James wants us to wrestle with is this. What secures your future? How do you look forward to the coming days and decades without despair? In a world where buildings crumble, in a world full of unpredictable tomorrows, how do you rest assured that everything is going to be okay? Because as we'll see, James is confident that this world won't last forever. It seems in James's mind, the status quo is on its last legs. We're in the last days. The world is coming apart. The way things are simply won't last. You'll hear as I read the verses, James suggests that the end of time is coming 5 times in these 12 verses. He says, the judge is at the door. And as a Vineyard church, you may know that one of the organizing principles of our theology is this kingdom theology of the kingdom. And you've probably heard the phrase, the already not yet. Right? The kingdom has come. Jesus said, the kingdom is at hand, it's here, and yet it hasn't come in fullness. So there's some sense that the kingdom is already, and yet, obviously, it's not fully here yet. The judge has not yet come to make everything right, and so we're waiting. This already not yet tension means that the kingdom we're waiting for, it's not a kingdom out there. It's not a kingdom far, far away. It's not a kingdom that's separated from us by distance. It's not a faraway kingdom to which we'll be whisked when we die and go far away. No, the kingdom we're waiting for is a not yet kingdom, which means that its distance from us is a distance in time. It's a kingdom separated from us in time. It's coming. It's coming soon. But the point is that it'll be right here on this dirt earth of ours. We're just waiting for justice to come in fullness. And James's message in chapter 5 encourages us and challenges us with this promise that the kingdom is coming, that the kingdom is coming soon, that already we're in the last days. And we've seen the glimpses. Actually, if you can imagine, remember, James is writing from Jerusalem. And in the last few years, James has seen Israel's Messiah walk out of the grave. They've seen mass conversions in Jerusalem, right where James is living and where he ministers. The promised Spirit has been poured out on all flesh. We've got men and women prophesying. The Gentiles are being grafted into Israel. These are last days sort of things, right? The kingdom has already begun to advance in the world. It's breaking in. And because we know that the kingdom is coming, we live differently. The kingdom we anticipate matters. In fact, this kingdom we anticipate is the decisive factor in our ethics. So in chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, James gives us a warning and an encouragement. He tells us what not to do and what to do. Specifically, if the kingdom is coming, we can't hoard money. If the kingdom's coming, we have to be generous. And if the kingdom is coming, we've got to be patient. So those are sort of the two chunks of text. Let me start with the first one. This is James 5, verses 1 through 6. This is what James says. He says, "Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the worker who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you." Now, I know that as a preaching team, we've joked that James is blunt in the kind of way where you might not want to invite James to your dinner party. But we can't get carried away and think that this kind of speech is unique to James. This isn't just grumpy old James talking. Yes, he's blunt, but nothing he says is the slightest bit out of line with the words of Jesus. In fact, Jesus can be just as blunt about economic injustice. Listen to Jesus in Luke 6, verses 24 through 25. This is what Jesus says. Jesus says, "Woe to you who are rich, for you've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep." The Bible presents a pretty consistent message about the dangers of wealth. And James is in complete agreement. But James is helpful for us here because he gives us three reasons why the rich are the target of harsh words. And we're going to look at his reasons. And as a last point of ground clearing before we look at James' reasons, when we think of the rich, we tend to think that's not me. But the truth is that some of us in the room right now, are rich beyond the wildest imagination of James. But because there are billionaires in the world, we tend to think, well, we're not rich like them, so we're not rich. Do you know that if you make $11,000 a year, you're in the top 15% of earners in the world? That means that if your budget is more than $30 a day, you are relatively wealthy. You're very well off compared to the rest of the world. And that's just the current world. In James's mind, you're Caesar. And the issue is that our media glamorizes insane wealth, right? And we love to watch the shows of the really rich people because it makes us feel better about what we have. We don't have as much as them. We don't have too much. Look how much they have. But most of us are actually relatively really wealthy. And sitting here in the most prosperous country in the history of the world, these aren't warnings we can afford to take lightly. So would you just listen to these warnings as though they were spoken to you, even if you don't feel rich? And actually, many of these points aren't really about the dollar amount in your bank account. They're more about habits of mind and heart towards our money. And again, sitting here in the most prosperous country in the history of human civilization, these aren't warnings we can afford to take lightly. So without further ado, here are James's three reasons why the rich should weep and mourn. Point one, worldly riches are a foolish thing to live for. Not to get too nerdy on you, but did you notice the tense in verses 2 and 3? James says, "Your wealth has rotted. Moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded." James is providing a picture of the not yet. These are perfect tense verbs. Providing a picture of the not yet as though it's already important. Right? He's telling the future in the present. He's talking about the not yet as though it's already happened. The prophets do this. They speak of what's coming as though it's already here so that we can prepare rightly. And the point is, if the kingdom is coming and coming soon, then we need to recognize that these things we devote our resources to collect, they're fading. They're wasting away. They're turning to dust. They're crumbling. They'll be eaten by moths, and already they are. They'll rust. In economic terms, given their future, the present value, present discounted value of these items is tanking. Simply put, the trinkets of this world are just a bad investment. And as kingdom people, we invest in the things that matter in the kingdom, right? In loving relationships, in kingdom shalom, in establishing justice and mercy and righteousness in our cities, in enduring friendships, because these are the realities that will be the architecture of the new heavens and new earth. The projected value of these things is quite literally infinite. They will last forever. In some ways, this first point is actually just common sense. Our culture recognizes this wisdom. That's why we have the proverb, you can't take it with you. Right? Worldly things are just a bad investment for the end of days. You can't take it with you. But James is saying more than that. He's not just saying you can't take it with you. He's saying wealth is a spiritual liability. It's a hazard. You know, Jesus says it's harder for rich people to get into the kingdom. So here's the second reason why the rich should weep and mourn. James says, the things that you own will eat you. Verse 3, their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. The things you own will pull your heart towards meaningless fluff. They'll orient your life towards pursuits that are passing as like a mist or a shadow of reality. But it's even worse than that. They won't just lead us astray. The things we own train us to prioritize material gain over love. They'll cause you to ignore the needy around you. In verse 4, James has to say, look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. Did you notice? They'll put us in competition with the people who we're supposed to think of as our brothers and sisters. They'll colonize our thoughts and hopes and dreams. They'll take up residence in our heart. Love of money will eat you. It will gnaw at your heart and devour your life from the inside out. Verse 3, again, their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. 1 Timothy 6:10 says that the love of money is the root of every kind of evil. In other words, if you fall in love with money, there's nothing you won't do for profit. There's no sin, there's no injustice that can't be traced back to love of money, can't be caused by love of money. You see, money is like a baited hook. If you've been fishing, you know that every once in a while, a fish will get the worm and not the hook. But you wouldn't recommend it. It's not really a wise thing to do, to go bite the bait, because you're going to get the hook most of the time. So Satan tosses the lure of money out in the water, and once you've bitten into it, once the hook is set on the inside, you can be dragged all over. The love of money leads to every kind of evil. And James actually mentions a specific kind of evil here connected to oppression. I'm looking at verses 5 and 6. James says, you've lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You've fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered the innocent one who is not opposing you. That's point 3. The reason why the rich should weep and mourn, it will cause you to kill Jesus. Or at least the people that Jesus identifies with. The rich should weep and mourn because their wealth has led them to condemn and murder the innocent. Remember, James just watched Jesus be killed by the powerful in Jerusalem. Economic injustice does harm. I think we often believe, especially those of us with privilege, that our economic habits are private. And we're free to do whatever we want with what we have. That our economic system is actually just morally neutral. And that is utter folly in biblical terms. Our economic decisions matter. Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. If our earning and spending habits turn a blind eye to injustice or support the oppression of workers or build our own little kingdoms, James would say, unless you change your ways, you'll rot like a sweater. And do you know that our God consistently identifies with the oppressed? You could argue that the constituting event of God's history with his people in the Old Testament begins with this kind of act of solidarity with the oppressed. God's people are in Egypt, and they've multiplied, and Pharaoh doesn't know what to do with them, so they've suppressed them, and they've subjected them to harsh slavery. And God's people are languishing under the lash of Pharaoh. And this is what God says in Exodus 3. I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's who our God is. And throughout the Old Testament, that's the starting point of how God's people knew who he was. He's a God who hears the cries of the oppressed. He's a God who acts to rescue. And by the way, woe to those who stand in the way. Spoiler alert, it doesn't end up well for Pharaoh. In fact, our God is so committed to identifying with the oppressed that he became an oppressed man. He became a craftsman living under imperial Roman rule. And he died a death reserved for non-citizens because it was so shameful. So here's the point of this first chunk of verses, this first six verses. The judge is coming back. And that affects our relationship to worldly wealth. So some of us in the room right now, some of us have too much. Some of us are wealthy beyond what's morally acceptable. And in a country as economically prosperous as ours, we need to take a long, hard, and honest look at our lives to assess whether the love of stuff has infected our way of thinking. Some of us have too much, and it causes us to run after Jesus with a limp. Others of us, on the other hand, have too little. Some of you live under the oppression of economic injustice, with unfair and undelivered wages, and God knows. God sees. God is with you. In fact, the point from this passage is this. Whether you have too much or you have too little, God knows. God sees. And one day, God is going to make it right. Now, if I'm perfectly honest with you, this is something I really wrestle with in both my relationship to wealth and my habits of consumption. Because if I'm honest about living in a country looking the way that I do, being a man, benefiting from injustice has supported my life and my education. As a white male citizen from an affluent family, some of these questions I don't know what to make of. They're really hard questions. And that doesn't even begin to consider the global inequality that we all benefit from. Do we really know that the factory workers who make our shoes are paid? Are we sure that the people who grew our food were fairly treated? It's pretty clear that God would take issue with our internalized attitude that our money is essentially ours to spend how we like. And woe to us if the cries of the oppressed ring out against us. And before I move on, let me encourage us quickly. If you've been given much, as some of us have, you've been called by God to use the resources he's given you for the establishment of his kingdom generously. And some of you are doing that. I've seen it in the church. And you need to hear that God is honored by your generosity. God sees that. And so I just want to say well done. And also to tell you that generosity is the best way to combat the spirit of materialism and the love of money that creeps into our hearts to destroy us. So well done. And then if you're relatively younger in your career like me, I want to encourage you that we have an opportunity to imagine a course for our life that doesn't put the pursuit of wealth at center stage. The inbreaking reality of the kingdom can inspire a different orientation for our lives. We don't have to use our careers to secure our futures. And this is important to say and to be explicit about because no one falls in love with money on purpose, right? People fall in love with money because of what it affords. I really think for most people, it's not about fast cars or nice clothes or whatever. Those things come later. For most people, they fall in love with money because money provides a way to make sure you get all the things you want in the future, not just material things. Money protects us against the variability and chaos of life. So did you see the temptation? Money is a way of securing our future. Essentially, money is a way to make sure we get the future we want. So accumulation, no matter the cost, that's the way to secure the future. That's what our culture teaches us. But this way of thinking about our finances as a way of shoring up our futures and our pleasures will fail us. Jesus tells a parable to this effect in Luke 12, verse 15 through 21. Jesus says, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And then he told them this parable. He said, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. So the man thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. And the striking thing about this parable is that this guy's basically practicing just sound economic wisdom according to our culture, right? That's what you're supposed to do. Build bigger barns so you can store more stuff. But Jesus says that's foolishness. This is the kind of foolish, self-securing mindset that affects us, infects us. This is the kind of thinking we have to be on guard against, because life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Securing our future through wealth is a false security, and it perpetuates injustice. It won't last. It will eat us alive, and it will lead us into sin. So that leads us to the second section of James chapter 5, these verses 7 through 12, and here's the headline for part 2. There's a better way to live. So let's read verses 7 through 12. James says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance, and I've seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. And above all, brothers and sisters, do not swear. Not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you'll be condemned. Look again at that last verse that comes sort of out of the blue, verse 12. He says, above all, brothers and sisters, do not swear. Not by heaven or earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you'll be condemned. Do you see how the prohibition of personal guarantees is deeply connected to the warning to the rich? Why do we swear? We swear because we want to assure someone that the future we're promising will surely come to pass. We swear when we want to personally guarantee a certain outcome. James is saying, don't pretend that you guarantee anything. The future isn't yours to control. It's the same temptation as the rich person. The rich person does it with their money. The swearer does it with their words. But here's the ethic that we're encouraged towards in verses 7 through 12. The message is, if the kingdom is and his the king and his kingdom is coming, what do? We be patient. And think with me here. What is patience? It's a species of waiting, right? It's a kind of waiting. Being patient is something you do when you're waiting for something that isn't here yet, right? But not all waiting is patient waiting. Patience is a particular kind of waiting. And so we're going to look at, James gives us three images to encourage us and direct us in our patience. As we wait with hope, how do we do it? Here's the first point. Because the judge is coming, we can be patient in our work. Look at the gardener in verse 7. James says, see how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. So this image makes it clear that the kind of patience that James is talking about is not just patiently sitting on your hands waiting for the future to come. Right? Renee talked about it. It's not folding your arms and sitting back in the back seat and saying, wake me up when we get there. Farmers work. Farmers plan ahead. They have to buy seed. They have to budget. That's the kind of patience that we're talking about. It's a working while waiting, right? But on the other hand, it's not a God helps those who help themselves kind of theology. It's not just go ahead and work and surely God will boost your efforts. James is talking about a diligent working that knows that it's not up to you to make the outcome come to pass. So an author that I love, Jacques Ellul, talks about, he says, the task of the Christian is to work hard at work worth doing, yet to know that it's God's part to weave our work into a larger story. God will make something of our work. God will make our lives meaningful, make our lives cohere with something greater like his kingdom. That's not up to us. It's not up to us to determine the meaning or the legacy of our work. That's on God. We plant, we sow, and we wait for the rain. So our work is postured with an expectation for a future that's out of our hands. if God doesn't send the rain, it's not going to work. So even as we work hard, we do it with an openness to a future that we can't manifest on our own. And already you may have noticed the slight shift in addressee here in the second set of verses. The first section was addressed, woe to you rich, right? The second section says, brothers and sisters. And the assumption is that these brothers and sisters are on the opposite side of the poverty line. Now it's worth recognizing that for some of you this morning, that's your situation. Living paycheck to paycheck. And it's hard to even think about the future. In fact, there are ways that poverty teaches you not to dream about what could be, not to make plans, because you've been disappointed and you've been mistreated again and again and again, and hope fails you again and again and again. And you've learned that if you plan long-term, you'll just get heartbroken. And honestly, in some ways, this is a difficult sermon for me because I have no idea what that's like. I've never not had enough. I've basically always known that I've had access to resources to freely imagine my future. And so truly, I sat in Ted's office this week and we talked about how can I preach this message? Because in a kind of way, I have no right to tell you how to live. I don't know what it's like to struggle in the way that you have. And I'm sensitive to that. So all I can do is tell you what Jesus says to you and tell you what James says to you. To the poor, Jesus says, there's a future worth putting your hope in. There's a future worth planning for and working hard for. There's a future that won't disappoint you. For James, patience is a posture informed by the fact that you're waiting for a future you can't create. It's out of your hands. You know that the future is out of your hands. You know that you can't secure the future by your own power. Which means this is really an encouragement both to the poor and to the rich. To the poor, Jesus says, there's a future worth putting your hope in. And to the rich, Jesus says, instead of trying to shore up resources to protect from all the vicissitudes of life, all the chaos of life, patience looks like eagerly anticipating the coming of Jesus' kingdom. Do you know that many of the farmlands in the American West, west of the Rockies, are irrigated by the Colorado River? So when it rains, they have enough water, but when they don't, they just pump out of the river. And in some ways, that makes economic sense, right? That way you're secured against the vicissitudes, the chaos of the future. But you see how it's a way of posturing yourself, securing your future by your own means, by technological means, by wealth. So their future is secure. They're not waiting for rain. And the effect of that, and this is really true, is that downstream there's no water. So in the cities in northern Mexico, they've been devastated because we took all their water. There's no water left. They're actually living in a decades-long man-made drought that we caused. But they don't get a vote about how America used their water. That's what happens when we try to secure our future by our own means. But the patient farmer works even as she waits for a future that's out of her hands. Patience is an openness to a future that you can't create on your own. So that's point one. Because the king is coming, we're patient in our work. And here's point two. Because the king is coming, we're patient in our hearts. This is tougher. Verse 9, James says, don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Don't grumble. So we don't just work and wait. We do it without grumbling against one another. That's a real challenge. What's grumbling? Complaining is when you do it outwardly. You do it externally. You say it out loud. Grumbling is when you say it inside. So you might not, maybe no one knows that you're complaining, but inside there's the, right? That's grumbling in your inner dialogue, in your heart. It's pretty clear James has experience with waiting, right? That's what happens when we wait. And what we're waiting for is delayed. What do we do when we get impatient or anxious about the thing that hasn't come yet? We grumble, right? We grumble at all the people that are standing in the way of the thing happening. We grumble at the person putting us on hold and not letting us get to achieve whatever goals we have, or putting you on hold again and then dropping your call. That's real. That happened like 2 days ago. And I wasn't just grumbling inside. I yelled across my apartment to my wife. That's real. We grumble at the person who cut us in line. We think they cut us in line. They say, no, I just went to the bathroom and she was saving my spot. We grumble. So freedom from grumbling means being patient to our core. It means being patient all the way down, all the way in the heart. It's not just patient in our work ethic that James is talking about. He's talking about being patient in ourselves. James is saying, don't just act patiently. Don't just perform patience. Be patient. That's point two. And in point three, James raises the bar yet again. This is verse 10. James says, brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. So the third point is, because the king and his kingdom are coming, because the judge is at the door, we can be patient in our struggles. James says, take the prophets as an example. I think of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was called to declare to God's people in God's city the message that the city would be destroyed. And they didn't like that. And he was persecuted relentlessly. And he wasn't just in a city under siege. They put him in a pit in the city that was under siege. You know what Jeremiah did when he got out of the pit? He bought land. He made an investment in the future of Jerusalem. That's persistence. Can you imagine? That's hope in the face of struggle. But how do you do that? How do you keep going? How do you have hope like that? How do you stay patient in circumstances like that? And that leads us to point four. We can be patient in our work, in our hearts, in our struggles. And none of that really makes sense until you get to point four. Point four is we can be patient because we know the end. Because we know the end. In verse 11, James says, as you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So you remember the story of Job? At the beginning of the story of Job, Job is economically blessed and he's righteous. And then he goes through hell, almost literally. And at the end of the story, what's the end that God intended? Job is more economically blessed than before. He has all that he lost restored, double. And he's more righteous than before. God intended something good. His story is an example for us that God is trustworthy to bring good no matter how bleak the circumstances look, no matter how chaotic. If our God is coming back and we know the end, then we can be patient. You and I can endure because we know the God that the end that God intends. James says, you've heard and you've seen what the Lord brought about. In other words, the already of the kingdom teaches us that the not yet is good enough to wait for. And this is so important. Our hope is not a general hope that things will get better, that things tend towards progress. That's not our hope. It's far more personal and specific than that. Our hope comes from the fact that we know the judge who's coming. We know the end that God intends because we know the God who is bringing all things to their rightful end. The one who is coming, the one who will sit on the throne of judgment, is the same one who, rather than cling to his life, rather than use his power to secure his future, he spread out his hands and gave himself away for others. And the good news is that it's this man, this condemned and murdered man, this man murdered by fearful people like you and me who were trying to secure their futures, he's on the throne. So the future we're waiting for, the end that is coming, is his kingdom. It's his future. So the point is, he secures the future so that we don't have to. When you really see that the entire scope of history is held securely in the hands of the risen Lord Jesus, that the one who suffered death rather than seek his own rights or claim his own kingdom, the one who loved us and spoke kindly to outcast sinners, the one who so aligned himself with the oppressed that the powerful killed him too, when you see that this Jesus is the judge who's coming back to bring history to its fulfillment, to its conclusion, you don't have to fear that future. So patience is waiting for a future that's out of our hands. Christian patience is waiting for a future secured by the nail-scarred hands of Jesus. He holds it. James's point is not just that we can't secure our futures. It's not just that we're too weak and if we try, we'll perpetuate injustice. It's that. But it's more than that. James' point is that we don't have to secure our futures because Jesus already has. So do you see how the gospel makes you generous? Even if in your past you've been an economic hoarder, even if that's your story right now, even if thus far you've accumulated wealth through injustice, the judge who himself suffered the consequences of our injustice, stands ready to offer forgiveness. And he gives us a better way to live. We can live without fear of what the future holds. We can live trusting rather than competing for resources, rather than anxiously scrambling for security. Just as he laid down his life, we can even lay down our fortunes, knowing that he has secured a reservation for us at the wedding feast of the Lamb. What do we have to fear? Honestly, what do we have to fear? I'm reminded of a hymn. It says, God sent his son, they called him Jesus. He came to love, heal, and forgive. He bled and died to buy my pardon. An empty grave is there to prove my Savior lives. And because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future, all life is worth the living, just because he lives. If Jesus died and is alive, if a resurrected man is reigning over the course of history, what can stop him? And if he has time and again demonstrated that he is for us, what do we have to fear? We don't need to pretend that it's on us to secure the future. He will build his kingdom, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Like we sang this morning, the poor will be blessed, the weary rest, and we will dance forever. He's making all things new. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you for your victory. We thank you that you didn't let our sin get in the way of your good purposes, your kingdom. Yeah, we thank you that you're triumphant, that nothing can stop your purposes, and that your purposes are always good. So Lord, make that real to our hearts this morning. Make us people who so believe that our future is secure that we can lay down our lives in expectation that you will give it back to us, that you will raise us up on the last day. We thank you, Jesus. Amen.